White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. This is episode 32 on January 31st, 2013. There's a lot of threes there. And there's no more days left in January. Now we're going into the short month. I am Carolyn Yeager and...
Hadding Scott.
Well, Hadding, I noticed this time in reading this, that now this is the third program at least in which Bernard Baruch is featured. And I finally noticed that he was from South Carolina.
Yes.
Do you think he had a Southern accent?
Probably a little bit. You know, I think I mentioned to you that his father was in the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that.
Yeah.
Immediately. So strange. Well, it's not so strange, actually. Okay.
Yeah, the original Ku Klux Klan, and I think even the revival Ku Klux Klan up until sometime... in the 1940s, probably. They really weren't very Jew conscious.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't know much about the history of the Klan, except what I read in Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
I like to think about it as a nice group from what they were doing in that novel and, you know, who they were and so on. Well, I am going to try, if I'm going to read Bernard Baruch's voice again tonight, he doesn't have such a big part, but... I'm going to try to use, and then you, I listened to a little bit about his voice, and so he had a little bit of a Southern accent, actually, a little twang,
bit.
And then a little bit of Jewishness comes out, too.
Well, he sounded a little bit like Baba Wawa on those R's, I think, but not too much. I mean, it would be ridiculous if you went the full Baba Wawa on him.
Yeah, well, he's, I don't know if he does it for the same reason. She's got a speech impediment or something.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing when you're a newscaster.
Right. But she makes it anyway, see? I don't know. All right. Well, you know, we've got a kind of reasonably, we've got 4,040 words this one is. I can't even think of what I'm trying to say. Never mind. Just straight on, no quotes or anything from the protocols. So why don't you just get started? We're in chapter 27.
27, yes. Jewish copper kings reap rich war profits. With this article, we shall dismiss Mr. Bernard M. Baruch for the present. His activities are not by any means to be construed as the main effort of Judah in the United States, nor is he himself to be regarded as an important factor in the Jewish world program. Indeed, it is to be doubted that he has been entrusted with many of the secrets of the elders. But he has been found to be a useful man, willing to play the Jewish game with Jews, and consciously bound, as all Jews are, by an obligation to see that Jewish interests get the better of the balance wherever possible. Mr. Baruch, of course, is much pleased with the role he was permitted to play in the government of the United States during the war, but he probably has sense enough to know that he was chosen for other than mere personal reasons. Indeed, one of the keys to the controlling part which a few Jews were permitted to play in American affairs during the war is to be found just here in the question, why was Mr. Baruch chosen? What had he been? What had he done that he should have been chosen as head and front of governmental power in the war? His antecedents do not account for it. Neither his personal nor commercial attainments account for it. What does? There was no elected member of the United States government who was closer, or even as close, to the president during the war as was this Jew out of Wall Street. No one whom the people sent to represent them at Washington ever came within leagues of the privileges accorded to Mr. Baruch. Plainly, this is an unusual situation, not explainable by the emergency at all, certainly not explainable by anything that is as yet a matter of public knowledge. And, of course, actually, it wasn't a real emergency. The United States went into the war by design.
Exactly. Emergency.
Yeah. As one man out of many, altogether serving the country, Mr. Baruch, of course, would be perfectly explainable. But as the man whose single committee was run up through the fabric of the Council of National Defense until it formed the focus of the war government, he is not explainable. It was not only during the war, but also after the armistice, that these tokens of signal choice were showered upon Mr. Baruch. He went to the peace conference. Reigning as chairman of the War Industries Board on December 31st, 1918.
All right, I'll read this.
Yeah, you're
I went off. Down. Okay, I'm Mr. Baruch here. I went down to my place in South Carolina and there received a wireless message from the president to come to Paris. I then went to Paris. I think I sailed about the 1st or 2nd of January. I know one vessel broke down and I had to transfer from one to the other. But I had no further activities in connection with the government, that is, with the War Industries Board.
Mr. Graham, how long were you in Paris? Mr. Baruch.
I sailed, returning June 28th or 29th. I came back on the George Washington.
This means that he was a part of the president's entourage. Mr. Graham, what were you doing there, Mr. Baruch? Mr. Baruch.
I was economic advisor connected with the peace mission.
Mr. Graham, you stayed until the peace treaty was concluded? Mr. Baruch.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Graham, did you frequently advise with the president while there? Mr. Baruch.
Whenever he asked my advice, I gave it. I had something to do with the reparation clauses. I was the American commissioner in charge of what they called the economic section. I was a member of the Supreme Economic Council in charge of raw materials.
Mr. Graham, did you sit in the council with the gentlemen who were negotiating the treaty? Mr. Baruch.
Yes, sir, sometimes.
Mr. Graham, all except the meetings that were participated in by the five, meaning the five premiers, Mr. Baruch.
And frequently those also.
This, then, is a sidelight on what has been called the Kosher Conference, a name given to the peace conference by Frenchmen who were astounded to see thousands of Jews from all parts of the world appear in Paris as the chosen counselors of the rulers of the nations. Jews were so conspicuous in the American mission as to excite comment everywhere. A Persian representative left on record this protest. When the United States delegation accepted a brief for the Jews and imposed a Jewish semi-state on Romania and Poland, they were firm as the granite rock, and no amount of opposition, no future deterrence, made any impression on their will. Accordingly, they had their own way, but in the case of Persia, they lost the fight. Although logic, humanity, justice, and the ordinances solemnly accepted by the great powers were all on their side. The comment is rather humiliating, but it is true. The Jewish World Program was the only program that passed through the peace conference without hindrance or revision. So numerous and ubiquitous were the international Jews at Paris, so firmly established in the inner councils, that the keen observer, Dr. E. J. Dillon, whose book, The Inside Story of the Peace Conference, published by Harper's, is the best that has appeared, was so constrained as to say this. It may seem amazing to some readers, but it is nonetheless a fact that a considerable number of delegates believed that the real influences behind the Anglo-Saxon peoples were Semitic. That's page 496. And again, they confronted the president's proposal on the subject of religious inequality, and in particular, the odd motive alleged for it, with the measures for the protection of minorities which he subsequently imposed on the lesser states, and which had for their keynote to satisfy the Jewish elements in Eastern Europe. And they concluded that the sequence of expedients framed and enforced in this direction were inspired by the Jews, assembled in Paris for the purpose of realizing their carefully thought-out program, which they succeeded in having substantially executed. However right or wrong these delegates may have been, it would be a dangerous mistake to ignore their views, seeing that they have since become one of the permanent elements of the situation. The formula into which this policy was thrown by the members of the conference, whose countries it affected, and who regarded it as fatal to the peace of Eastern Europe, was this. Henceforth, the world will be governed by the Anglo-Saxon peoples, who in turn are swayed by their Jewish elements. That's page 497. And Emile Dillon, he was born in Dublin, by the way. He was a journalist, and also for a brief period he taught Sanskrit, classical Armenian, and comparative philology at the University of Kharkov in the Ukraine.
Well, you know, Hedding, I looked up that book, and you can get it on Amazon, and actually they have some used copies that aren't so much, but it said that it's not accurate, or it could have missing parts, and it could have this and that, you know. I didn't quite understand that they're selling this book, but they're saying that you can't be sure about that everything is in it that's supposed to be in it.
Well, I guess that would be a used book then.
Yeah, but I think even they had two there, and there was no real description except that was the book description.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't find out anything about it. Obviously, maybe you think they don't want people to.
Well, it should be on Google Books.
Uh-huh.
Should be for free on Google Books.
Yeah.
Might not be, but it probably is.
Okay.
There are other matters pertaining to Mr. Baruch which must await the development of this study, but it is worthwhile just now to possess ourselves of the information at hand regarding his particular handling of the copper situation during the war. Mr. Baruch is known as a copper man. Copper is Jewish. That metal, throughout the world, is under Jewish domination. The Guggenheims and the Lewisons, two Jewish families, are the copper kings of the planet. Not that they confine themselves to copper. For example, their output of silver throughout the world is one-fourth more than is produced in the entire United States. By his own testimony, Mr. Baruch was interested in copper concerns. What his holdings were during the war, he did not disclose. But what his actions were has been very clearly set forth, bit by bit, in various inquiries. Before the United States entered the war, Mr. Baruch rounded up the copper kings. You're on, Shmuley.
Oh, sorry. I went to New York and there saw Mr. John D. Ryan and Mr. Daniel Guggenheim.
He said in his testimony, this was in February or March 1917. He wasn't sure which, but he said it was before we went into the war. Now, who were these gentlemen? Mr. Ryan was, apparently, in charge of the reorganized Lewison properties, while Mr. Guggenheim was chief of the seven Guggenheims who form a business family and a family business. They divided business during the war. the United Metals Selling Company, which sold the United States government its copper during the war, was the Lewisohn business reorganized, of which Tobias Wolfson was vice president. And the American Smelting and Refining Company was apparently the Guggenheim interests.
Well, let me just, I'll just interject here that I did a little research on the Guggenheims. Nothing fancy, but yeah, there were seven brothers who, I mean, seven sons of the, what was his name, Leopold Guggenheim, who came, who immigrated from Switzerland, a Jew, in 1847. And he had these sons, well, actually, Daniel was the best businessman, obviously. And he was born here in the United States in 1850-something. And they had 11 children altogether. Anyway, it was like a family business. It was very much like the Rothschilds because, oh, yeah, this guy's name was Meyer. Yeah, Meyer Guggenheim was the patriarch of the family. And he had these seven sons, and they all worked in the business. And they, you know, became very, very, very successful, and especially in 1900. They took over a big company. I have it in the, I'll have it in the post, but I had some letters, named with letters. From there, they were set themselves up to be all ready to have copper to sell to all the Allies once the war started. And yeah, that's what they did. It wasn't just the United States they were selling their copper to. And, of course, they were into other mining, but this was, I guess copper was really important in World War II. That's the way they make it sound. They needed it for whatever kind of weapons and planes and so on.
Well, copper, in particular, copper is used for cartridges, ammunition cartridges.
Okay, well, anyway, yeah, millions and millions of pounds, hundreds of millions of pounds, they... the United States had to buy from these, from these Jews. All right.
Okay. Okay, he was referring to the Guggenheim and Lewisohn copper interests, and he says, there was no competition between these two during the war. How did it come about that these two worked together? Their case is clear on paper. Their answer is that Mr. Baruch asked them to. And Mr. Baruch is clear, too. Was he not a government official? And did they not show patriotism in doing as the government official bade them? It came to this. The government made a rule that it would do business only through the American Metals Selling Company, as the representative of the copper producers of the United States. This meant, of course, that if the few competitors of this Jewish copper combine were to do business with the government, they too had to make arrangements with the American Metals Selling Company. Mr. Graham, but how did it happen that you were representing the other companies who were your competition? Mr. Wolfson, well, at the request of the War Industries Board, we offered a copper producers committee. Mr. Graham, who requested that? Mr. Wilson, Mr. Eugene Meyer, Jr., representing a Mr. B.M. Baruch. Mr. Graham, now let us find out who Mr. Eugene Meyer, Jr. was. Do you know him? It develops that Mr. Eugene Meyer, Jr. is another Wall Street man who... quote, had large investments in copper, close quote, though whether he retained them during the war, Mr. Wolfson did not know. Mr. Graham, and Eugene Meyer Jr. went into the War Industries Board and took up with the copper producers the question of furnishing copper, did he? Mr. Wolfson, yes, sir. As a result of that request, a meeting was held at 120 Broadway, at which were present, among a few others, S.S. Rosenstam, L. Vogelstein, or Vogelstein, Julius Loeb, T. Wolfson, G.W. Drucker, and Eugene Meyer, Jr.
Now, aren't every one of those are Jews, aren't they?
Probably.
I'm sure. The only Drucker could, you know, is probably a Jew, and all the rest of them.
It's yeah.
Just really something. They didn't, you know, they didn't try to cover it up at that time.
Okay. Mr. Graham. Any army officers there? Mr. Wolfson. No. The witnesses here quoted, Tobias Wolfson, or the witness here quoted, Tobias Wolfson, was one of the most active instruments in the actual passage of business. But the Washington representative was a Mr. Mosehauer. The interesting thing about Mr. Mosehauer is that he represented both the American Metals Selling Company and the American Smelting and Refining Company, the Lewisohns and the Guggenheims. And by order of Baruch, with the approval of the government, the business was done with these two corporations. How did they divide? It was very simple. Mr. Wolfson euphoniously describes it as a division of labor. The Lewisohn Group took the trade with the United States. The Guggenheim Group took over the foreign business with the Allies. Now, the next interesting point is the special committee through which Baruch's board dealt with the copper producers. This committee, representing the government, consisted of three persons: Pope Yeatman, chief; E.C. Thurston, assistant; Andrew Waltz, assistant. Pope Yeatman was a mining engineer employed by the Guggenheims at $100,000 a year. E.C., that was a lot of money back then. That's like,
yeah, and he's supposed to represent the government, but he was an employee of Guggenheim.
E.C. Thurston was Pope Yeatman's assistant in that private employment. Andrew Waltz was consulting mining engineer for the Guggenheims. Everything was all set. The Jewish metal monopoly was assured of control on both sides of the Atlantic. It was perhaps thought desirable, in view of the bad political odor which had accompanied the copper power in several states, mostly in connection with the copper senators, like Clark of Nevada. And readers of this series will remember that in connection with the name of Guggenheim, it was Senator Simon Guggenheim who fought against the census enumeration of Jews as once proposed by the census officials. Mostly in connection with the copper senators like Clark of Nevada, it happened that something be done to gild the arrangement. That was awkwardly composed.
Yeah, I don't even have it in mind.
You don't have that?
The census officials after that, then it says that something to be done to... I must have... Maybe I screwed it up somehow. I don't know.
No.
Yeah, let's remember that we talked about that a while back, how they... You know, how they would not allow Jews to be counted in the census and how much power they had in doing that and how they used the fact that Judaism was a religion and you didn't mark that people had a certain religion. You know, it wasn't a race and they got away with that. The same Senator Simon Guggenheim fought for that.
Yeah, when they don't want to be a race, they're a religion. When they don't, you know.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, you know.
Well, anyway. To themselves, they're a race.
Yeah.
They don't want other people to call them that.
It was apparently necessary to do something to disarm the protest that might arise against this thorough Judaizing of the war metals. Therefore, a very fine show of patriotism was made. This is worthy of notice in view of the show institutions mentioned in the protocols. The American public is becoming accustomed to these show institutions, proposals which promise everything and then fade away into nothingness. It is one of the most effective methods of destroying the morale of a people, or getting people to do things that they otherwise would hesitate to do.
Well, you're right. They call it show institutions. It's basically a lot of propagandizing that they set up. But this is really interesting when he
empty
talks
promises.
About how they do it. Yeah.
Empty promises. When Mr. Baruch saw the heads of the two copper families, he says he found them willing to think of nothing but giving copper to the government. Money was of no consideration whatever. Mr. Baruch.
They said that so far as the United States government itself was concerned, they would give Uncle Sam all the copper he wanted for his preparedness campaign at any price that was decided upon. In order to arrive at some price, we took the average price for 10 years, which was about 16 2/3 cents. And that is how the price happened to be arrived at. At the time that they said this, copper was selling somewhere around 32 35 cents a pound.
Yeah. There, then, was a magnanimous thing. The government was to be given copper at half the market price. But did the government get it at this price? Wait, the story is a good one. This unheard-of sacrifice of profits for patriotism was extensively advertised. The Secretary of the Council of National Defense wrote a stirring story for one of the best magazines, in which he said, Mr. Baruch first announced his presence in the tremendous task of mobilizing American industry by procuring 45 million pounds of copper for the Army and Navy at about half the current market price, saving the government in the neighborhood of $10 million. Mr. Baruch himself, in his testimony, expanded with the generosity of it all. In an apparent mood of help yourself all you want to all you want, he said,
on inquiry, we found that the Army and Navy wanted only 45 million pounds, which used to be a lot of copper before we got to dealing in astronomical figures, and they were given all the opportunity to consider what they wanted. They could just as well have had 450 million pounds as 45 million pounds, because there was an open offer.
Now, for the effect which this produced on the country at large.
The effect of that offer to the copper producers was electrical,
said Mr. Baruch.
It showed that there was, in this country, a desire to set aside selfishness, so far as our government was concerned, in its need. Make us any price you want. So that was practically the attitude that the producers took.
But the government did not get copper at that much-advertised patriotic price. Mr. Graham, they did not pay 16 2/3 cents for the 45 million pounds, Mr. Baruch.
Oh, no, not these other large quantities of materials.
He said that the copper was furnished to the government without receiving money for it. Price fixing was yet in the future.
Then we came to the point. Well, what about the civilian population? So we made a rule that became a policy, that whatever price was fixed, it should be for everybody, that what was fair for the Army and Navy was fair for the civilian population.
There seems to have been a rapid cooling of generosity under the prospect of colossal sales. And the upshot of it was that after all the hurrah, the government really paid about 27 cents. What these figures mean can be deduced from the fact that during the war, the government bought 592,258,674 pounds of copper. If the reader is not already staggered by the import of these facts, there remains one more for him to consider. After the armistice, the surplus copper was sold back to the copper producers. In April and May 1919, the American Metals Selling Company received from the United States government over 16,500,000 pounds of copper at a fraction over 15 cents. This was less than the boasted patriotic price of 16 2/3 cents at the beginning, not counting what they had received from the government for the copper in the first place. Their profits on the difference between the price they paid for the surplus copper and the price for which they sold it again were beyond counting.
You know, I don't really have a good picture of just what they did here, how they did this, because they said they set this price that government could buy it at any price it wanted to give, you know, but they was talking about 16 2/3 cents a pound. Then they say that there was no money received for it. And then they did some price fixing, and then they end up with the government paying 27 cents. And then when the government sells back what they didn't use after the war, it's only at 15 cents. Now this is very much like our usury here, like the Federal Reserve does things. I'd probably not exactly like that, but you know, where we're paying for things that are ours or that we shouldn't be paying for, we're constantly paying these Jews. Didn't somebody object to this? I mean, what do you think, Hattie? This is so crazy.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit confusing, but I think what it means is that they only really established the price for the first 45 million pounds of copper, but the actual amount bought was over 500 million pounds, and that the price on the amount above 45 million was different than the price on the first 45 million.
So they did all that publicity. That's it. They did all that publicity, that show stuff, to talk about the price. And then it wasn't a firm thing that was being held throughout the war. So,
yeah.
Okay. All right. I didn't catch that.
Yeah. It's kind of like what they call a loss leader.
Yeah. Yeah. Come in and buy this at, 50% off or more. And then there's only two or three of them. And then the next day they bring out all the rest of them.
Yeah.
Or something.
All right. This is what occurred under the triple copper monarchy of the Baruchs, the Louisons, and the Guggenheims, and their Jewish assistants and Gentile fronts. However, Gentile fronts were boldly dispensed with to a very large degree during the war. The real powers behind the throne themselves stood out and did not hesitate to set their own people at every crossroads along the line of war business. At every crossroads along the line of war business. It is not to be supposed that the Baruch influence began or ceased with copper, nor with any of the multitudinous industrial powers which he possessed. A man like Baruch makes the most of such opportunities as were then his. In matters political, personal, and even military, there were many openings for the use of his influence. And well-informed people about Washington did not doubt his facility in these things. Once, however, Mr. Baruch felt he was skating on thin ice with regard to the law. He had gone ahead on his own plan, but in such a way that he would exercise the power without taking responsibility. That seems to have been a very clear ideal with him, power without responsibility. And I'll just point out here that that's usually the kind of position that Jews like to occupy. You'll notice... Well, if you remember in the Bush administration, it was loaded with Jews, but the Jews usually, and it was also true in Clinton, I haven't looked closely at the Obama administration, but the Jews usually are the number two guys. Like Dick Cheney's chief of staff was that Jew-Douglas fight. And Rumsfeld's number two was Wolfowitz. The Jews are the number two guys, so if there's any real trouble, they won't be the main target.
Well, yeah, they go into that a bit here, and that they set it up. Well, that's the front guys. You know, there could be different reasons, partly because, you know, then we don't see Jews as actually running our government. Because a lot of people don't even pay attention to all these other folks who are the assistants and the, you know, in the departments with important positions and really doing the making decisions. We just see the front man. But the other would be this, that yeah, they figure it out so that when something goes wrong, they're not responsible, or something comes out, or something is, you know, corrupt, some scandal. They're not the responsible one.
Yeah.
But we are getting smarter about this, I think, or maybe it's just I am, whereas I know more about what goes on behind the scenes in government than you know, maybe I once did, or once paid, if when I wasn't paying attention.
Well, I can give you another. This is maybe the most important example of how Jews exercise power in this country without responsibility, and that would be the mass media. Mass media effectively rule the country. They beat the drum for wars. And then when finally they get a president in there that goes ahead and responds to all the propaganda, like they spent 15 years beating the drums for war against Saddam Hussein, essentially. When they get a president that finally goes ahead and does it, and it turns out to be a disaster, they might turn against him. You know, he's their scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
Alternately, of course, at the New York Times, they had this Jewish reporter, Judith Miller, that sent these ridiculous reports back from Iraq, and they let them slide. The editors at the New York Times must have known better, because I criticized those reports myself at the time because they were just ridiculous on their face. The editors had to know that they were reporting baloney. But then, when there was a scandal about Judith Miller, she took all the burden for it. She became the sole scapegoat, and the higher ups at the New York Times they put all the blame on her.
And yeah, and when they do that, there's nothing you can do because you're powerless.
Yeah,
mass media.
Mass media are a prime example of power without responsibility. If they report something that's not true, it's very hard to make them suffer for it. Very hard. If there's a retraction, it'll be on page 9 or whatever.
Yeah, I've noticed that disinfo agents like to continue to bring up George W. Bush, you know, as the culprit of when they want to talk about 9/11, they want to bring up George Bush
or Dick Cheney very often.
And Dick Cheney, well, together, you know, and that group, and they don't go farther, you know, into the ones who are really involved in all that. But yeah, so that's a very good point. I think that there's more here. They're going to go into this.
All right. That seems to have been a very clear ideal with Bernard Baruch: power without responsibility. Everything was fixed. All the conditions within which every contract would have to be made were carefully determined. But Mr. Baruch never permitted himself or his board to make a contract. After having consulted with numbers of his associates in business, an agreement was reached, and only then were the responsible officers of the government told, "Go ahead and make contracts." The officials took the responsibility, but the Baruch coterie made the conditions and then remained aloof. Even this plan, however, had a questionable aspect which came to trouble Mr. Baruch, and the manner in which he manipulated the matter shows either a very shrewd mind or else very shrewd advice. The latter undoubtedly went with the former. There were plenty of Jewish advisors about. To begin with, Mr. Baruch says,
The members of that committee were picked out by myself. The industries did not pick them out.
which means, in fact, that Mr. Baruch picked out a group from a group that had previously been chosen by the producers. Although plainly, Mr. Baruch was desirous of modifying this impression. And again,
it is true that these great Kappa producers were on the committee, and I selected them because they were great men.
Now, these men, as members of a government committee, were to all appearances selling to themselves as members of the government committee, and apparently buying from themselves as owners and controllers of the great producing combinations. Not necessarily in any discreditable way, but in a very unusual way. In the face of this condition, Mr. Baruch had the coolness to say,
So you can see that the government was as much in the saddle as it was possible to be.
The producer members of the committee, headed by Baruch, were the government, so far as this statement is concerned. Time and again, it was shown that the responsible officials of the government were not even visible until this extra government had determined all the conditions. Mr. Garrett, did any troubles arise with the committees growing out of the legal situation that you remember of? Mr. Baruch.
The committees of the trade, especially some of those that I had asked to serve, were very much disturbed about the standing in reference to the Sherman antitrust law. Is that what you refer to?
Mr. Garrett. Yes, Mr. Baruch.
And also in regard to the Lever Act, on the point that no man could serve two masters, there was no basis for it, because these men were not serving two masters. They did not make trades with themselves, but with the instrumentality provided, carried out the government's wishes or orders or suggestions with reference to the particular industry which they represented.
The instrumentality with which the copper men dealt, for example, was the American Metals Selling Company, which, together with the American Smelting and Refining Company, was represented at Washington by Mr. Mosehauer. The Special Copper Committee, composed of Guggenheim employees, did business pertaining to the instrumentality, which carried on the business of the combined copper industries, companies. It was dangerous. Some of the members seemed to have felt it before Mr. Baruch did. Mr. Baruch never seems to have questioned anything that he did. Why should he? He, quote, had more power than any other man in the war, close quote, and he had the most powerful and autocratic backing that a man ever had. But the others, the non-Jewish members, were thinking of the law. So Mr. Baruch solved it very nicely. He took the committees comprising the same men and had them named as committees of the United States Chamber of Commerce for their various industries, and although the process was not changed in the least, the legal aspect of it was changed. It was rather clever. It was typical. And after that, Mr. Baruch, who had previously insisted that he himself had picked those men and that the industries had not, thus clearly encouraging the inference that these men did not represent the industry's side, but the government side of the matter, he now insists that they represented the industry. Mr. Graham, you changed and took these advisory committees and had the National Chamber of Commerce reappoint them so that they then were direct representatives of the Chamber of Commerce, and not of the officials of the United States or connected with any governmental machinery? Mr. Baruch.
I never considered them officials of the government, Mr. Graham.
Okay. Mr. Graham. They were not, they were as much officials of the government as the rest of you, were they not? Mr. Baruch.
I do not think so.
After several questions.
I asked them to serve so that when the government wanted anything, they could go to one small, compact body, rather than to send out to I don't know how many people. You see?
Mr. Graham, let us see about that. They were serving under you, were they not? You were the head, Mr. Baruch.
I appointed them and asked them to do this so that I could have a compact body to deal with.
Mr. Graham, you did not think for a minute that they were representing the government, but did you not think you were, Mr. Baruch?
I was doing the best I knew how.
Mr. Graham, but you had authority to bring these men in, Mr. Baruch, and appoint them as committee men under you, and you did so. Surely, if they were representing anybody, it was the government, was it not, Mr. Baruch?
I do not think so.
Mr. Graham, am I right in assuming that you thought they represented the industries, Mr. Baruch?
Yes.
A great deal, of course, can be overlooked in men who were working under stress and endeavoring to do things the best way. It does not follow that because a businessman serves the government in matters pertaining to his own business, he is necessarily dishonest. But so frequent is dishonesty under such conditions, or if not dishonesty, then a loss to the government because of a divided interest, that laws have to be framed to regulate such matters. These laws were on the books at the time. This is a fact, whatever else may be true, that copper made tens and hundreds of millions out of the war. And it is not at all inconceivable that if copper had not been so completely in control of the government operations of purchase, the profits might not have been so great. And the burdens which the people bore through taxation, high prices, and liberty bonds might not have been so heavy. Mr. Baruch is but one illustration of the clustering of Jewry about the war machinery of the United States. If the Jews were the only people left in the United States who were able enough to be put in the important places of power, well and good. But if they were not, why were they there in such uniform and systematized control? It is a definite situation that is discussed. The thing is there, and is unchangeably a matter of history. How can it be explained? End of chapter.
Very good, Hanning. This appeared in the 11th December 1920 issue of the Dearborn Independent. Now, he asked this very important question at the end, and we are really left with it, although I think this chapter explains it, and lots of other chapters have explained it, but, you know, he's still there just saying, how can it be explained? Hoping that people will be seeking an explanation, I guess. But that's one thing we can chat about a little bit here in the 10 minutes that we have left. But another I'd like to bring up in relation to this is that, as you probably know, on Monday night, I read this speech that I got hold of. From Adolf Hitler, 1920, why we are anti-Semites. Great speech, I think, of his early speeches and talks and his early thinking. And, you know, he was bringing up at that time, because this was the same time, it was 1920, and he was bringing up what the Jews were doing in Germany during the war and how they stayed behind, and they were left behind, the left-behind people or whatever, and we're doing business and running things and making a lot of money while the national people were out over there on the fronts fighting and dying and so on, so being injured. And this is the same thing we have right here. So it was no doubt going on in Britain and France and everywhere else. you know, even though we see them as going along with it, they probably weren't really. I mean, but the Jews had this control. And, of course, it's always brought out here in the International Jew that it was at this, you saw it at the peace conference after the war, that the Jews got everything they wanted. And so they were the winners of the whole thing. It's really just atrocious. It should be so much better understood. And these are the kind of issues that are just not popular with people to understand unless you're somebody, you know, there's those who are really interested and really care, really want to know, like our listeners here. Yeah. But most people, they just go on and this becomes ancient history. And so it's repeated. So what do you comment to that?
Well, I think the fundamental fact there is that the Jews are a nation unto themselves. And they pursue their own collective interest. Or maybe they pursue an individual interest. But in any case, they tend not to have a very strong identification with the interest of the nation among whom they live. That's the fundamental fact. You can't reasonably expect patriotism from people that are a nation unto themselves, separate from your nation. It's not realistic.
Yeah, see, but then they give us this song and dance, like with the copper selling, that they're so patriotic and they're gonna forego their profits they should be getting, you know, for the government because of wartime and so on. They give us all this baloney all the time. And we don't seem to have a way to, well, we don't have a way to fight it because we don't have the media. How did they get control? Back in the 20s, 1920s, here, Henry Ford's writers are telling us how the Jews had controlled the media. Adolf Hitler was telling us how the Jews controlled the media in Germany. And how long had they been controlling the media already?
Well, in Germany, the problem wasn't as bad as here because.
Well, it was. He said there was. I think he said 95% or something like that. They did control all the media. There was very little media at that time.
There was a media magnate named Hugenberg that supported the Deutsche Nationale Volkspartei. And in the late 1920s, when those conservatives decided that they would support Hitler, that's when Hitler started having big success. So there were some real Germans that owned some mass media in Germany.
Well, you know, during the 30s and even up into the 40s, we had the Hearst Corporation and the Chicago Tribune in Chicago that were conservative and were supporting isolationism, as they like to call it, you know, not getting into the war. And that was big, and they ran things, but it still wasn't as powerful as what the Jews could pull together.
Well,
you know,
the thing with the Jews, I mean, that's been outlined, you know, earlier. They worked together to get control of specific industries.
Mm-hmm.
And they will, you know, they'll live with a loss on something for a while, you know, just to maintain control in a particular field. They'll make sacrifices in order to maintain power for the sake of Jewry.
Well, there you go. You said a little bit ago that maybe they were doing it as individuals, but they don't because they know that they're not powerful as individuals. So they do work together, and I think that's the answer to the question, how can it be explained that this chapter asks at the end, more than that they control the media or this or that, but that they work together the way they do. That's the great power that they have.
Yeah. And Forbes says that they got financing from Jews in Europe when they came to America.
True.
I don't think he goes into a lot of detail about financing for what, but you can imagine that Hollywood was built up on financing from Jewish financiers in Europe. And the takeover of mass media in the United States probably also. I mean, imagine how it would be here if we had a lot of money put in say from Germany, to help us build up some white media in this country. That would help a lot.
Sure, we don't have anybody. There's all kinds of wealthy people who are kind of, look at Mel Gibson. People keep bringing up him. Why won't he help? What's wrong with these people? They don't do anything. Maybe they don't trust any group to do the right thing, or, you know, and maybe we're not used to functioning that way, and maybe we would. Sometimes people have gotten a lot of money. Let's look at the IHR. When they got those millions and lost the whole bundle of it through a, God knows, we still don't have the story straight about that. Different people say different things, but we don't have that history of working together, and we're a lot larger, so you have to have a manageable group to do that. And that's where their small numbers actually work into their benefit. So it's a lot of things to think about, but I think that's really the key.
Well, part of the problem that we have is we have a lot of people that will kind of become irresponsible at some point, or a lot of people that just don't even seem very responsible in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people that might be willing to donate money may tend to hold off just because they don't see anybody that seems really worthy of it.
I agree. Who can handle it without just piddling it away? They don't know how to handle it. And now the Jews have had going, this is their nature. See, going back all the way through their history, they have been very money conscious, whatever form money took at the time. And they, you know, so they, as Hitler said in that speech, even if a Jew is at the opera during the most beautiful, uplifting part of the opera, you can see that he's calculating dividends. It's funny, but at the same time, that's a power that we might not want to be like that at all, but that's something that they never quit doing. They never quit thinking about business and money, and so they're ahead of us all the time in that, because they're thinking ahead and they're planning. That's all they seem to care about. And yeah. And this is a powerful enemy that has gotten hold of world finance and world everything else.
Yeah, well, they're also pretty good, I think, or at least better than we are, about policing their own people.
You know, we should form a smaller group of really serious people who have, you know, the right ideas, or what we think are the right ideas, and function in that way instead of trying to pull everybody together, all these white people. It can never be done. That's my newest thoughts that have kind of concretized recently. So, well, we have 30 seconds, so we can say have a nice good night and thank our listeners and tell you that next week, we're not going to be going on to answer this question. That's why we could talk about it tonight, because we're moving on to how Jews control the theater, isn't it, Hanning? Something
like
that.
That's what it says, theater.
Yeah, now we're getting into the arts and the stuff in New York City. It's going to be very interesting. This has been a little heavy, this business we've been going through, but we've gotten a lot of people downloading it, so they want to know about it. Okay, let's say goodnight.
Good night.
Hooray, Jake, hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.